This is Radio Naturopath here on WHUS 91.7 FM. Okay, so we have a series where we're going through and explaining the six basic principles of naturopathic medicine, because that's always an important thing to do, and it's important that I like to make sure that people understand exactly what naturopathic medicine is. So we have the fifth basic principle of naturopathic medicine, which is treat the whole person. So I don't know if that has a Latin name, because the other ones, we talk about their Latin name, but this one we kind of don't. So anyway, treat the whole person is really important. And if you know how to say it in Latin, you can let me know that. I would say email me at radionaturopath@gmail.com and I'll be able to look at it. But anyway, treat the whole person means that when we are interacting with you in terms of your naturopathic health care, we want to know all about you, that anything that's going on in your life can affect your state of health. And so we're not going to just be looking at one condition. One of the things that I hear my patients complaining about is if they go to a regular physician. Now, again, I don't want to call out all physicians, because all physicians don't do this. But this is a more common practice as healthcare becomes more privatized and more regimented, and where doctors are required to only see you for single conditions and for only 5 to 15 minutes if you're lucky. You have to be very short and efficient with your care, and they find out what the one condition is and they give you one remedy and off you go. And that remedy is usually some kind of a drug. And so, for example, if you have poison ivy, they're going to look at you, they're going to say either your poison ivy isn't serious enough to get steroids or it is. And if it's serious enough to get steroids, you're going to get steroids. And that's it. Maybe some topical cortisone cream to control the poison ivy. But they're not necessarily looking at you as a whole person, and they're also not necessarily working with your body. Now, if you have very serious poison ivy, you might need a corticosteroid, but prednisone or something like that, to suppress the inflammation. We're not crazy about suppression, because suppression in our minds does not work with your body. We want your body to be able to heal itself. And yet, we do have modern medicine to get people out of physical jams. There are things that we can do today in modern medicine that we couldn't do thousands of years ago that save lives. And if people have poison ivy seriously enough, that is affecting their entire bodies, sometimes the prednisone is what you do. We don't like to do it because the principle of using corticosteroids isn't in keeping with general naturopathic medicine. When you do corticosteroids, as we said, they're suppressive to the immune system and they're not working with the body. And we also believe that when you use steroids, you're driving the illness deeper into the body so it can reemerge in a deeper way somewhere else. So for example, if you're using steroids to suppress your eczema, it may turn up somewhere else and you'll wind up getting asthma. So that the inflammatory tendency is still there, but because you've suppressed it on the skin, the tendency towards inflammation still exists, but you've suppressed it with the steroids on the surface so that those inflammatory compounds are still there. So they're going to go affect some other organ where they're not being directly affected by those steroids. And it keeps going deeper and deeper into the body and you can't effect cure. So when you're talking about treating the whole person, treating the whole person means that you come in and you're a human being and you have a whole life, and your life started pretty much when you were born and maybe even before that. And so anything that's going on in your life can help your health now. So, and also things that are going on in your life can affect specific conditions. So for example, I see a lot of people with heart rhythm abnormalities, right? And so, you know, if you have a heart rhythm abnormality, the MD is going to probably do a number of things. Say you have atrial fibrillation. Okay, if you have atrial fibrillation, what is that? That is an irregular heartbeat where there's a pattern that's consistent with the term fibrillation. And when you listen to somebody with atrial fibrillation, when you listen to their heartbeat is very irregular. If the atrial fibrillation isn't too serious, the person has this skippy heartbeat, bum, 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 bum. It's kind of interesting because, you know, your heartbeat is supposed to go bum, 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 bum. You could do a little rhythm to that. But atrial fibrillation kind of sounds like jazz. So if that's a positive way of looking at it, it really does. It's a it's an interesting rhythm, and it's not it's like listening to bebop jazz because it's kind of all over the place. And if it's not too serious and the heart itself is still functioning well, then they may not do too much about it. Most people are going to at least be given some kind of medication. And the medications they're often given for atrial fibrillation are they're medications to slow the heartbeat and to help to regularize it. So they might be given a beta blocker. A beta blocker is a beta adrenergic blocker. That means that slows down slows down your fight or flight response. That's basically how it works. And so it's going to slow down your heartbeat and make it more regular. Other hypertension drugs, drugs for high blood pressure, are also used. So you might be given you might be given a calcium channel blocker or an ACE inhibitor like lisinopril or verapamil, some drugs like that. And you also generally are going to be given an anticoagulant because the worry with atrial fibrillation is with the erratic heartbeat, if the valves are beating against each other in an irregular way, you're going to get turbulent blood flow, and turbulent blood flow leads to blood clots. When you have a blood clots can do bad things like escape, and they can get into your lungs and block them, or they can cause atherosclerosis. But the thing that they're really concerned about is that the blood clot, you're going to get a pulmonary embolism. That is, you're going to get a blockage in your lungs, or you're going to get a blockage in a deep vein, perhaps in your leg. And so that's what they usually do. So in naturopathic medicine, we're going to look at that and we're going to try to regularize the heart rhythm again. If you're using these drugs, people often don't feel well on beta blockers because they really slow your pulse down and they give you exercise intolerance. They often do. And they can even make you depressed because they just slow your heart rate down so much. They slow your circulation down. And they're often given to people that you may have atrial fibrillation and not have high blood pressure, but they lower your blood pressure anyway. And if that happens to you, you're not going to feel good. So it's really interesting. And so you have to talk to the person about what that's going to do to them in their lives. So say you have somebody who's an athlete who has atrial fibrillation, and that's not unusual because we see a higher rate of atrial fibrillation in athletes. High-level athleticism can bring on atrial fibrillation. What I'm not clear about is if it brings on atrial fibrillation in people who are predisposed to it, or if it can come on in anyone. If you're overtrained, are you more likely to come down with atrial fibrillation, that you're going to get what's actually going on in your heart is there are places in your heart where the heart tissue is somewhat damaged. So you're getting skips in the electrical current in different places in your heart, and that's why you're getting the fibrillation. So you have to talk to the person, see what this means to them. Some people, if they're not exercising a lot and you give them a beta blocker, not going to bother them too much, and they'll go ahead and they'll take their beta blocker and it'll be fine for them. Also, depending on what you give them for anticoagulation, that can be a problem too. People often don't feel well. Often people are given warfarin or Coumadin as an anticoagulant, and a lot of times people don't feel well on that either. It does definitely thin your blood. And what does that term mean, thin your blood? Thin your blood means that your platelets, which are the blood cells that stick together so that you can form clots, they don't stick together as well. So you're less likely to form clots. But what's interesting about that is people who take warfarin, you know how you say, oh, I'm cold, I think my blood is thin. What I'm not sure about is if in the winter your blood does thicken up, that you do in fact become more coagulable. I'm not sure if that's true or not, but one of the things that you do see people taking warfarin or Coumadin is that they feel cold. They tend to feel colder than people who are not on it. So that's one thing that they do report. The other thing that I see is that people have brain fog, their thought processes are interrupted, and they are tired. They don't have as much energy. So I think it affects your circulation, how well your blood in general gets to different parts of your body. So you have to check in with people. How are they going to feel about this? And I do have patients who decline coagulation or anticoagulation, and their cardiologists worry about them. So if you're a person who's going to, that's something I'm going to talk to you about. Now, if your doctor really thinks you need the anticoagulation, you know, that's something you have to do. You have to do a long, hard talk and soul searching and be aware that you have a risk that you can clot. We can give you things that can anticoagulate, and they're things that aren't going to affect you as negatively as things like warfarin or the factor 10 inhibitors, like your the things that end in grel, clopidogrel and apixaban and Xarelto is the other one. I can't remember what the name for it is, that the generic name. But anyway, so the factor 10 inhibitors are that's something else you can give, but they all have side effect profiles that are not as good as things like fish oil and vitamin E and magnesium and eating a salad and eating berries, because you can reduce coagulation by doing those things. That what's not clear is, can you reduce coagulation as well as you can with a drug? And so that's something that you have to think about, and that's a risk that you have to take. So we don't know. So that's something you have to work out with your patients. So if your patient comes in and says, I'm an athlete and I feel terrible when I'm on a beta blocker, that's something you want to know about them. So if you get to know the person and get to find out what's actually going on with them, you get to find out that, hey, in fact, I am an athlete. I go on the TCC Saturday ride and I want to keep up with the B ride. And if you put me on metoprolol, I'm not going to be able to do that. And I'm going to be very sad. And so here's a person who's trying to exercise to improve their health, and you're going to give them a drug that's going to make it so they can't do that. So treating the whole person means you're talking to them about what's going on in their lives and how that's going to affect them. So I had a very interesting patient a while back who had some kind of arrhythmia, and I talked to her about one of the things that you do is when you're talking to people about their natural health, you talk to them about emotions that are associated with the organ that they're talking about. And for some of you, that's going to sound like, oh, how can emotions be associated with an organ? Well, you know, thousands of years of Chinese medicine can't be all wrong, first of all, because there are emotions associated with all of the organs in Chinese medicine. And to an extent in Western medicine, in Western natural medicine, we do think of, we do think basically of emotions being associated with various organs. A lot of times they're the same organs, the same emotions that Chinese medicine has done a really nice job of pairing emotions with certain organs. So for example, the heart. If you have an issue with your heart, could there be something affecting your heart? Now, of course, one of the emotions affecting the heart is associated with joy. And if you are not joyous, you might feel sad. However, the lungs are actually associated with sadness. That's the emotion of the lungs, grief and sadness. However, in sort of Chinese, a conflation of Chinese and Western medicine, I had this woman come in. She had an arrhythmia. She really didn't want to go on long-term medication. And in fact, if she took good care of herself, most of the time she didn't have the arrhythmia. She had been offered an ablation. An ablation is where they go in and they electrocauterize spots in your heart where they believe the arrhythmia to be, and then that can take away the arrhythmia. It's kind of a cool thing if it works. And for some people, it does work. It's great. But some people don't want to have that kind of invasive procedure, and she really didn't want to do that. So I said to her, we'll call her Joanne. I said to her, that's not her name, but I'm going to call her Joanne. I said, Joanne, so just in doing due diligence and doing all of naturopathic medicine, I just want to ask you, is there anything going on in your life that's hard for you that could be affecting your heart? Anything, you know, in terms of love or sadness or joy that's affecting you, that's making you upset? And you know what she did? She went, wah! She just burst into tears. I'm like, okay, I guess I hit that one. So I had her tell me what was going on, and she definitely had some stuff going on with her family in terms of how she was being treated. And she didn't like the way someone in her family was treating her. So she articulated quite nicely to me. So I looked at her and said, Joanne, so did you tell him? And she said, well, no. So you didn't say it the way you said it to me. No. All right. Will you please go home and do that? Sit him down and say it to him, just like you said to me, and see what happens. So she did. And she went home and she said it to him. And the guy was like, oh my goodness, I didn't know. Sometimes it really, really pays to go home and say it to him like you said it to your nice doctor or your nice counselor or your nice whoever. Because she went home and used her words and said it to him. And he said, I had no idea I was doing that. I'm so sorry. And he did a 180. And he made sure to treat her the way that she wanted to be treated. And she was much better after that. And then her heart rhythm actually stabilized. And so to this day, she goes through phases. If she's under more stress or if she doesn't eat right or, you know, she something happens in her life that's stressful or like maybe she's working really hard and gets really sweaty and doesn't eat right or something happens like that, she'll get flare-ups. But they're few and far between, and she knows how to manage them, and she does know that there's emotional component to it. And often there is an emotional component to things that are going on in your body. It's really interesting. And so when you get to know your patients as human beings, you get to find that stuff out. One of the things I do is when you come into my office, before you come in, you're going to be sent a 4-page health history form. And the health history form is really useful. And my patients will see that sometimes I'll go through the whole thing and sometimes I won't necessarily. And I actually had somebody say to me, aren't you going to go through the health history form? I said, yes, but part of the health history form is it's a record and I'm going to study it more carefully after you go. And there's going to be some things I'm going to look at and I want to talk to you, the person, right now. But after you go, when I do your charting later, I'm going to look at your whole health history form, see if there's anything I missed and anything I need to talk to you about next time. So, and it's also a good record. We want to have that in your chart to refer back to, because I do use it extensively. It's a very useful tool for me, not just the first day I see you, but right on through. And so if you go away and I don't see you for more than 3 years, I have you fill out a new one. Why? Because things change. And I find that a very useful tool. It's an extensive health history form. It's 4 pages long, and it includes things like what are all your previous conditions? Have you been hospitalized? What's your family history? And it goes through a review of all your systems. What are things that have been going on in your body in your life? And you're going to check off by the time you've left the office, I already know how many times a week you go poop, which is great. And you think that's funny, but that's a very important thing for a naturopath to know, because whether or not you're constipated is a good sign of your health. And we want you to be regular as a good sign of your health. So that's part of knowing as much as we can about you. Now, mind you, if there's stuff you don't want to tell us, I always say that to a patient. I'll go to a patient, is there anything upsetting or stressful going on in your life? And please feel free to tell me as little or as much as you want. And usually when you say, please feel free to tell me as little or as much as you want, they err on the side of telling me as much as they want. So because now you've given them the forum, say, you're safe. You can tell me whatever you want. You can tell me as much or as little. So now they feel safe. So they're going to tell you stuff. So it's a good tool to use. And I do mean it. If you don't want to tell me something, please respect your own privacy. And I respect it too. You can only tell me so much. And, I'll have people admitting stuff to me 2 or 3 visits in. I didn't want to tell you this, but, and I'm like, it's okay. You didn't know me when you met me. You can wait. You tell me things when you're ready. Of course, as much as you can tell me, the better I'm going to be able to help you. But if you're not ready to tell me something, then don't tell me. It's okay. Sometimes I figure things out too. Like if you don't tell me that really you've been drinking 4 drinks a night and that's affecting your health and your sleep, and that's part, or maybe you haven't thought about the fact that you're drinking 4 drinks a night can really affect your health, I might figure it out because I see you have elevated liver enzymes. And then I'm going to go ahead and then when you have elevated liver enzymes, there's a whole bunch of tests I have to run to see if you have infectious hepatitis, if you have certain viruses, if you have other conditions that elevate liver enzymes. And I'm going to do your GGT, gamma-glutamyl transferase, which is an indicator of whether you've been drinking. Now, you can have an elevated GGT and not be drinking, but that's one of the things so I might find out by asking you. So anyway, so treating the whole person is hugely important It's about me looking at you as a whole person, looking at all the factors that are going on in your life, finding out what you're doing. That's why we ask what your occupation is. And if you're not occupied, how you spend your time. So say you're retired. A retired person, I'm like, what are you doing with yourself? How are you spending your time? Because that if you're sitting on the couch eating bonbons and watching TV, you're going to have a very different life than if you are running around to every volunteer organization. You're doing your art and you're showing your art because you're one of the artists in the country, or you're going out to lunch with your friends all the time. I mean, people can be doing any number of things, and everything you do affects your state of health. So I want to know stuff like that. And the more we know, the better that we can help you. So we're looking at you not as Joe Asma. We're looking at you as a whole person with a first and a last and maybe even a middle name, and with a family and a life and with children and parents and caregiving and going to the gym and dancing and being sad about your illness, being angry about your illness, and everything else that could be going on in your life. So all of those things play into your state of health. And so when you walk in, we are looking at you as a whole person. One thing I like to say is that I have extensive knowledge about how to help people heal. I have lots of knowledge about nutrition and homeopathy and herbs and acupuncture and all kinds of natural medicine things I can help you with, and all kinds of conventional medicine things I can either help you with or direct you to. But you have intensive knowledge about yourself. You know more about you than anyone else does. I know about it in, you know, medical terms, but you know about you at a personal level. And I can't help you heal without you. So you are an extremely integral part of your own healthcare. You need to be your own advocate. And I encourage you to be your own advocate. That's why, you know, doctors are sort of, when patients come in, it's like, well, I read on the internet. I like to, sometimes you're like, ugh. But you try not to do the thing, because this is a patient who is interested in finding things out about their health. And sometimes they happen upon things that you want to investigate. And also, really, when a patient goes and finds out stuff on the internet, you want to honor them, say, what did you find out, and help to demystify that. And, you know, you might be able to tell them whether that thing they found on the internet applies to them or is valid or is a good source. So you don't just assume that it's, that it's worthless, because this is a patient who's interested in helping themselves heal. Now, sometimes patients can scare themselves, because if they have a condition, they're going to think that condition, they're going to go to the worst case scenario, and they're going to think that that's what's going to go on for them. And that may not be the case. So it's definitely something worth honoring your patient around, that if they're doing their own research, it's okay. This is a patient who's motivated and interested in healing themselves, and you can allay their fears. Because one of the things that's going on too, that you have to realize, when the patient comes in, they're probably anxious. They're probably anxious about meeting you. They're probably anxious about their care. They probably don't understand how their bodies work. It's often amazing to me, and maybe it shouldn't surprise me too much, but people really have limited knowledge of how their bodies work. They've been diagnosed with hypothyroidism, and they don't really know what that means. And I'll sit and demystify it for them. They'll come in with labs that their doctor did for them, and then I will do labs with them. And then I'll explain in great detail exactly what those labs mean. And when a patient says, I don't understand what you just said, I make sure I stop and say, okay, let me explain that to you. And I take the time to explain it and make sure that they understand in their own terms. So it's very respectful to a patient to make sure that they understand what's going on, what the treatment you're doing is, what condition they have, what they can expect, and just to be kind to them and allay their fears and let them know that no matter what happens, you're there for them, and you're going to, you're going to be there to support them, and that you're there to answer their questions in whatever way that they need. So So that's treat the whole person. It's a very, very important part of naturopathic medicine that you're honoring the good human that has walked into your office, wherever they're at, and you're honoring their knowledge base and you're helping them to understand their bodies better. And you're using all of the information that you can find to help them on their own healing path. It's a good thing. All right. So so update on my poor knee, my bursitis. So I'm checking my bursa right here now, and my bursa is pretty good, I have to say. So I'm just wondering how much of this is time, how much of it is rest. I haven't been pushing it. I haven't been riding my bike super hard. I am back on the bike. I did get on the bike last week, and I'm doing slow, short rides, although Saturday I probably overdid it because I went on a wonderful ride with our lovely elder in our club, Saul Nesselroth, who turned 91 on Tuesday, yesterday. So happy birthday to Saul. And so I rode with him and a couple of nice people. So I rode a nice 17-mile ride with them. And then I got back to the parking lot. I'm like, oh, it's only 9:30. So, or something like that. And I'm like, oh, I want to ride some more. So I got hold of my dear friend Diane and found that the Sea Ride was still up in stores. So I said, all right, I'll meet you. They were headed for the Red Barn. So I met them at the Red Barn. So I did a little more riding. And that meant climbing up Browns Road, which is kind of hard. I probably should have done that. But I didn't do too bad. I mean, I'm going very slow and very easy. I'm not pushing it. And I'm going to go, we're going to do the Farm to Fork Fondo in Vermont this weekend. And we're pretty excited about that. And what I hear is that the roads, there's not a super lot of climbing on this ride. And a lot of the roads go from, they're on the islands. They're in the Hero Islands in the Lake Champlain. So I'm really looking forward to that. I've never been to Burlington. Yippee, going to Burlington, Vermont. Been to Burlington, New Jersey many times. And so if you're wondering about the Burlington Coat Factory, people joke about the Burlington Coat Factory. Oh, is that based in Burlington, Vermont? It sounds so like because you need coats in Vermont. Nope, it is surely not. Burlington Coat Factory is a place where mom took me when I was a kid, and it was about 20 miles from home. And it was a big warehouse made of cinder blocks, and it was a very unassuming place in Burlington, New Jersey, right on Route 130 in Burlington, just south of where my sister and my nephews and brother-in-law live in Florence. And I drive down Route 130. Route 130 in that part of New Jersey is kind of like the Berlin Turnpike. That and all kinds of commerce on it, and it's just a big old state highway. And the Burlington Coat Factory doesn't look like the nice Burlington coat factories or the Burlington stores that you see now. It just looked like a cinder block building, and you went in there as a huge warehouse, and it was full of all kinds of coats, and mostly coats and good deals. And then one day they decided to have this Burlington store. And I remember that the one of the first Burlington stores went up in Lawrenceville, New Jersey, which is a little bit north of where the original Burlington Coat Factory was. And then those stores started popping up everywhere. And then eventually they closed the original store. So, but the Burlington headquarters, I'm not sure if the Burlington headquarters is in Burlington or if it's a little further north on Route 130, but it's still on Route 130. In New Jersey, it might be in Robbinsville or Allentown. I'm not sure. But it's a big headquarters, and it's not the same building. It's a big, flashy headquarters with, you know, high-rise and glass and stuff like that. So just so you know. But anyway, we're going to Burlington, Vermont. We're going to be in Lake Champlain. That'll be nice. And I will have to figure out. I'm going to get the okay to ride, I don't know, 35 or 50 miles today from my chiropractor. And that's one of the things that I've been doing. I've been continuing to go and get care. I've been seeing my chiropractor regularly, good old Dr. Suez. I've been seeing my acupuncturist, Nicole, out in Scotland, Connecticut. Would love to go back to Scotland, the country, but you know, she's in Scotland, Connecticut, not too far from me, and still got the tape. So the tape that I'm using, because one of the things I'm totally allowed to do is swim. If you're going to use athletic tape and you want to swim, you need to get special athletic tape that's meant for the water. And one tape that I'm using with success is the Extreme Tape. So it has to show you on the box that it is meant for getting wet. And it really does stick to you. You get about 5 days out of it, which is really great. So you can shower in it. You can go for swims in it. And, you know, it'll start to peel off in, like, I've got a couple peely spots at the top here. If it's not anchored to your skin, it will definitely peel. But so you definitely need it to have it make skin contact. But it's really quite something. It does stick very nicely to your skin, even if you go swimming in it. There's a nice picture of me on Facebook with the beautiful pink tape, but the pink tape is not the extreme tape. And I went for a nice swim in Columbia Lake, and you can see me sitting on the dock of the bay, kicking out my pink taped knee, and it's peeling off. So if you're going to be sweating a lot, if you're in very humid conditions, if you're going to be swimming with athletic tape on, you want to use something that's called, there's the extreme tape, and or find a tape that is meant for use in the water. And sometimes if you go to the actual physical therapist, they have high-grade tape that's meant for that. That's meant for pretty much any situation. So I was told pretty much that I have bursitis, and I think it's getting better, that it's just over time, the thing's getting better. I'm noticing that I can bend my knee much further than I could a week ago, even, and definitely 2 weeks ago. It's not all the way better, so I'm having to be careful. It is affecting how far I can ride. I'm not doing any intervals, but I'm able to ride, so I'm just riding slow and just sort of enjoying myself. The other thing that I'm finding is that because I'm not doing intervals and I'm not caring about how fast I'm, like, the most important thing is not how fast I go. The most important thing is that I ride in a way that supports my health. I'm having to pay very close attention to that, and riding is very enjoyable. I'm like, why didn't I figure this out, that I need to spend some time just getting out of the game and getting out of the, oh, I've got to go as fast as I can, and just take some time off and just do the joy of riding and not worry about how fast I go, and ride with people who don't generally ride as fast. And you meet different people. It's just wonderful. I just had so much fun on Saturday riding with the Sea Level Ride and Saul's Ride, and just enjoying myself. It's really nice. And not having, it's just so good for your head to take that time off and not give yourself a hard time. Now, that's not going to apply to somebody as much who has to get out there and start exercising in the first place. But if you're pushing yourself really hard, it's a good idea to take some time to not push yourself hard. And what professional cyclists do, like one of the things I've heard Amber Pierce say, for example, is, you know, after she's done with her race season in September, October, she just rides for pleasure, and she doesn't go at a particular pace. And then at some point she gets off the bike for a month. And that's really good for you too, just to not have to worry about it. Because when you get back on it, it's a pleasure. And you find that you miss it, and you want to get to the point where you miss it so that you want to be there. All right. So I've continued to use a homeopathic gel on my knee that is really helpful. I haven't experimented too much yet. I have a handheld, what's supposed to be a cold laser, although I showed it to Dr. Suez and he said it's probably a good quality LED light. So I need to experiment with that more. And that's something that can speed healing. And that's really nice. I am taking pyridoxal 5-phosphate, which is activated vitamin B6. I do think that that's quite helpful. Then also treating myself for Lyme disease. So I think I had a flare or a new case of Lyme disease. And I'm doing, as I probably said last week, I'm taking some amoxicillin, and along with Saccharomyces boulardii. I have to remind you that when you take antibiotics, it's a really good idea to take Saccharomyces boulardii, that specifically, because when you take antibiotics, it's gonna affect your gut flora. And if you take Saccharomyces boulardii, it's a probiotic yeast that can't be killed by antibiotics, and it will keep everything really nice, keeps everything working really well. And then you can do ordinary probiotics on top of the bacterial probiotics, but some of them are going to get killed. Or maybe a lot of them are going to get killed, but the Sac Boulardii keeps everything really nice. And I'm starting to wonder, Sac Boulardii has other nice properties too, because it goes after unfriendly bacteria and it outcompetes yeast. And I give Sac Boulardii to people who have a lot of diarrhea, and it seems to help with that as well. So if you have a yeast problem, one of the things you can do is take Saccharomyces boulardii, which is also a yeast. So if you have been diagnosed with candida, like if you have bowel candida or you have candida affecting you in other places in your body, if you take Saccharomyces boulardii, it's a yeast. It will go after the same nutrients and resources to grow, and yet it's a probiotic. So it creates, instead of creating an acid environment, creates an alkaline environment for you, except in your colon, you want it to be more acidic. So it does that for you. It makes organic acids, makes vitamins, it makes you regular. It does the nice things that probiotic bacteria do for you. So you don't have to be on antibiotics to take it. And I always recommend to people, if you are taking Saccharomyces boulardii during the course of your antibiotic, you want to continue to take it for at least a week or more after finishing your antibiotic. And again, there are good things about it that can help people who aren't even on antibiotics. It's a really nice probiotic. So the other thing was, Dr. Swez, I said I could go back. I was enjoined from doing my core exercises because they were too much of a strain on my knee. And I was also doing some leg stabilization exercises. So some wall leg lifts, and I do some one-legged deadlifts, and I was enjoined from doing those. And I was told last week that I could go back to doing them. So I'm very happy about that. And then, you know, there were certain core exercises I was not to do because of the strain on my knee. And among those were hip bridges and planks. And then I also do bird dogs, which is where you get on all fours and you pull your opposite elbow to meet your opposite knee. And you do a bunch of those. And because I'm supporting on the knee, I was enjoined from doing that. Well, I was told I could go back to doing that. And I've been doing them, and so much better. And one of the things that I found is that when I let go of my core exercises, my back started to hurt. And I didn't like that. So I was very happy to go back to doing the core. And I do recommend doing a little bit of core. Even if you can do some core twice a week, it will really help your back. It's amazing. There are times of the year when I just get into doing core twice a week. Right now I'm trying to do core, you know, every other day, like four times a week I do core. If I'm doing a really intense workout, like a long ride, I will tend not to do it that day. But on days when I'm doing short rides, and then I have a free day, a day when I don't exercise, and then I'm probably not going to do the core. But I try to get in the core 4 days a week. And there are 2 days a week when I'm doing resistance training, and I do it on along with the resistance training. So really, even if all you did was some planks, and you know, do planks for, I hold my plank, my front plank for a minute, and I don't do more than a minute. Some people do these challenges where they get up to 5 minutes. Not interested, because I find that if I do it for a minute, I'll do it. And I find that the minute is difficult. It's still difficult, you know. So I don't feel the need to go more than a minute. If I do, maybe in the winter, I'll be interested in that. But if I challenge myself to do a minute and do it most days a week, I do it. And then I do side planks, and I do them 30 seconds. I could probably hold the side planks for longer than that, but I don't. I hold them for 30 seconds. Why? Because I'll do it. What's the best exercise for you to do? Guess what? The one you'll do. So I am kind to myself and don't over demand on myself. And that's something that I'm having to figure out, that I was doing some training and I think I was overdoing it. And that's why I got hurt. And so I have to back down. I have to have respect for the fact that I'm a 54-year-old lady and I need more rest. I need more sleep. And so we're trying to figure this thing out, and how much do I want to train, and how fast do I want to go, and how far do I, all that kind of stuff. So I have actually, this is a summer where obviously I have to back down and actively get more rest, because this has sidelined me a little bit. And so, you know, that chair in the backyard and the iced tea, they're waiting for me. Love that iced tea. So what can I say? All right. By the way, so let's go on to another topic. I was going to talk about a couple of conditions, but let's talk about iced tea for a second. And I repeat this periodically, but I think it bears repeating. I'm surprised at how many people don't know this. Did you know that white tea, green tea, and black tea are all the same plant? Not everybody knows that. And even though I've said it before on this show, I figure it bears repeating, because in the last week, I said to a patient, did you know that white, green, and black tea are the same plant? And they said, no. So a lot of people don't know that. So Just so you know, they're all the same plant. The plant is Camellia sinensis. So let's look up Camellia sinensis. Yeah, and I love this plant. Camellia. Here we go. All right. Camellia sinensis. Anyway, so Camellia sinensis is this great plant, and it is the plant that are green, black, and white tea. So what it is, it's a nice plant, and if you saw the plant, it's a rather unassuming plant, and it even has flowers. I didn't know that that's what tea flowers look like, and that's the tea plant. So its leaf and leaves and leaf buds are used to make tea. And so how does it work? Why are the plants white, green, and black? Well, here's why. When you have a tea plant, it starts out when the leaves are forming, the leaves are closed up and they have little white hairs on them. So if you pick them at just the right time, they look white. So you pick them. And if you pick them that way, when it looks white, that's white tea. And the neat thing about white tea is it has the immune properties of the most salient thing in the white tea. So in terms, if you're really looking to have a lot of immune properties in your tea, white tea is the way to go. Because at the time there's a whole science called gemotherapy. And gemotherapy, you're using plants at early stages of growth. So you're using rootlets, you're using buds, you're using leaves that are furled, that they're closed up. So you're using parts of the plant at a very early stage of development. So they're going to have growth factors and nutrients in them that they have at no other time in their development. So when you're having the white tea is going to have more immune properties. So the thing is, personally, this time of year, I love to have my tea cold. Not everybody does. If you like to have hot tea, even in the summer, that's fine. But I like to have iced tea. White tea is very refreshing. It's very mild tasting, and it takes quite nicely to having fruit added to it. So that's something you can certainly do. Right now, the peaches are perfect. I got some perfect peaches, and they're absolutely perfect. So adding peach to anything is going to be amazing and wonderful right now. So white tea and peach, awesome combination. In fact, quite honestly, peach and any tea. I like peach tea. My favorite thing is to have lemon in my tea, but I also love to have peach in my tea. I find it really refreshing. I like that flavor profile. Peach, mango, apricot. Yeah, peach, mango, and apricot. They're all kind of similar. They have like similar properties to them, and I really adore that flavor. I like a lot of flavors, but that's one I gravitate towards. Having a peach that's just at the perfect stage of ripeness, it's not mealy, and it's really juicy. And when you open it up, when you bite into it, you're a mess because there's juice everywhere. Perfect peach. Wonderful. One of the wonderful things about me having summertime and growing, being able to grow peaches in Connecticut. So I got some local Connecticut peaches and woohoo. So white tea, immune properties. Now, so you let that white tea, now you let the little plant, let the leaves open up, and now you have the leaves are open up. Now they look kind of green, and you pick them at a nice young stage, a fresh stage of their development, and they're green. And then you steam them lightly, and now you have green tea. That's green tea, and it's the same plant. All right. So you have green tea, and the thing about green tea is you can have them in different forms. They can be flavored with different things. Like if you have jasmine green tea, it means that the green tea has been steamed with jasmine flowers, and that's delightful, really lovely. Green tea can come from different places. The thing about tea is if you're a tea connoisseur, tea can be grown different places. It can be grown at different spots on the mountain, and it can be grown in different places in the world. And the tea is going to have a different flavor profile depending on where it's grown. So if you're a tea specialist, that might be a fun thing to do, get a tea specialist on the show and have them talk about all about tea. It would be really interesting. So green tea can taste different based on its quality and where it was grown, and some brands and some flavors are better than others. That's something you have to mess around with, but there are certain brands that are definitely higher quality. And I will say the jasmine green is lovely hot with honey, and jasmine green is lovely iced on its own or with lemon. Very refreshing. And personally, I like to sweeten it just a little bit. I still, because I enjoy my tea, I want to have a little sweet in it to take away the bitter edge, but I still want to taste some of the bitter. So you don't want to oversweeten it. So I'm not going to be drinking sweet tea. So sweet tea is something they do in the South, which I have great respect for, by the way. It's basically, would you like some tea with your sugar? It is so sweet. And what you do is you prepare the tea with the sugar into it. You melt the sugar in with the tea, and that's how you prepare it. So when I'm down South, I love being down South because they have a lot of respect for their tea, and you can get sweet tea down there. And they understand that some people like unsweet tea. So I get half and half. And that's awesome. I just love being in the South and getting my sweet and unsweet tea. And so green tea is wonderful, iced or hot. And green tea, you'll bring out the flavonoids in the green tea if you add lemon to it. So you get more bioavailable flavonoids, the compounds that are anti-inflammatory and anti-cancer and do nice things for your liver. You will have those be more bioavailable if you put lemon in your tea. So lemon is a good thing to do. If you want to do peach, you could do the peach, but maybe want to do the lemon too, because that's good too. I can vouch for that. It's very yummy to have both the peach and the lemon in there. Okay, so that's green tea, and green tea has a lot of polyphenols. And green tea, all of the teas have theanine in them, which is a lovely compound that is calming, and that may be why, even if you're drinking strong tea, it still has a calming property to it, because it actually has this theanine, which calms you down. So I do better personally because I can't do too much caffeine. I do well with tea because of the theanine. The theanine calms me down. And whereas coffee, I kind of have to be in the mood for, or it has to be oversweetened, and even then I don't always want it. And I'm often getting coffee and not finishing it. I will never do that with tea. I love to drink tea. I'm always in the mood for tea. So then black tea, what's black tea? Black tea is you take those tea leaves and you ferment them. And if you ferment them a little bit, now you have oolong tea, which is what the Chinese tea you get in Chinese restaurants tastes like. It's usually oolong tea. It has a special flavor. Oolong has been studied to be helpful for fat loss. All of the teas will be helpful for that, but oolong just has nice studies on it that says it can help to hasten fat loss. So try oolong tea, see if that's something you might like. And again, you can do it hot or iced, whatever you would like. And then there's black tea. Black tea, you ferment it for longer, and then you're going to have your characteristic tastes and properties. And then in terms of how and where it's grown, you're going to have different varieties, so they're going to taste a little bit different. I told Pearl, who's a local tea specialist, that I love Assam tea, and she said that Assam is the tea that that people who like coffee often go for because it's strongly flavored. And I kind of like my tea to be kind of on the strong side. When I make iced tea, I like to use a good quality brand. I have found that your more, you know, commercial, conventionally available teas, I don't like the taste of, and the reason I understand is because of the part of the plant that they use. And they may not be using as good quality leaves, but they don't use the right part of the plant. You're supposed to just use the tips of the leaves and not necessarily the whole plant. So you can tell when somebody's used a poor quality tea. The other thing that drives me nuts is that tea goes bad if tea is not pasteurized, it'll go bad. So a lot of times I'll go into a cafe or a restaurant and I'll ask for iced tea, and they have it sitting there. And if they've had it sitting there for a couple of days or maybe all day and it's been hot out, the tea will start to ferment. And it doesn't taste like kombucha. It tastes like tea gone bad, and it doesn't taste good. So you can taste when somebody's done that. So you have to, if you are a shop owner, and you're either, you have to make your tea fresh every day, or you have to refrigerate it, or both. You can't leave it out, and you can't leave it out for too long. And nobody bothers to taste it to see if it's gone off. And so I feel really lucky when I go into a restaurant or a cafe and the tea is fresh, and it doesn't, you can taste that it hasn't been allowed to ferment. I'll make iced tea, and then I'll make cold tea, which I can then make a glass of iced tea. I make it a little concentrated so that I can pour it over ice and it's not so concentrated. And I'll leave it in the fridge, and of course I don't pasteurize it. What I probably should do is put the lemon into it, and it might last longer because lemon will act as an antioxidant. But if you don't pasteurize your tea, it's going to go bad. And so it only lasts a few days in the fridge and then doesn't taste good. So shop owners, please refrigerate your tea. If you go to some of the larger chain cafes that understand such things, they don't keep it around. They keep cycling through it. And if it's a certain amount of time old, they throw it out. So that's what we've talked about today. We've gone on about first do no harm. We've gone on about the healing power of nature, and a little bit more about how to heal a sore knee. So you've been listening to 91.7 FM, WHUS Storrs. I am Fran Storch, and this has been Radio Naturopath. It has been my pleasure to spend time with you today. This is a call-in talk show about health and natural medicine. You can email me with questions and comments at radionaturopath@gmail.com. If you'd like to listen to this show at another time, you can check out our podcast at whus.org. You can also leave questions or comments at my Facebook page, Twitter, and Instagram at FranStorchND. Thank you for listening to Radio Naturopath, your show where you can learn about the best of science and nature. We'll be back with more Radio Naturopath next week. I'll have two very special guests. I'm going to have John Norton, and I'm going to have Joe Sereno, who are going to be, they have their own podcast called Go Health Yourself. So it'll be a meeting of Radio Naturopath and Go Health Yourself. And it will be very interesting because they are going to be talking about particularly their journeys with mental illness and how they have made it through with a combination of life things they're doing, counseling, pharmaceuticals, and their different life experiences. They're two lovely young men, and I can't wait to have them on. So you can tune in next week here at 10 o'clock, and you can listen to me and Joe and John, and we'll have a great time, and you can go health yourself. But for this week, we'll be back with more Radio Naturopath next week here at 91.7 FM WHUS Storrs.